Hello, everybody. This is Dale Chase with the Department of Consumer Affairs. We're getting ready to start the law label workshop. Just wanted to kind of, before we get going here, to do some introductions before, we can actually do a tally on the phone as well. Again, my name is Dale Chase. I'm the Acting Bureau Chief here at the, and go ahead and go around the table.
This is Rich Inver. I'm the chemist.
I'm Rose Pacoda, and I'm a chemist.
I'm Terry Hackman Foe, lab manager.
I'm Joanne Carney, advisory council member.
Hi, I'm Lauren Scott, American
Health Care Council. And on the phone, if we start with the East Coast, can somebody identify themselves? Anybody on the East Coast?
Maggie Carey with Legal Label.
I'm Yolanda, you're
over. My name is Sybil Tudor-Woman.
I don't know, Sarah Geiser. Robin, the
Hostess and Furniture.
Joanna Contreras, Delta Enterprise.
Laura Woods, Lexington Woman.
Bob Johnson, Walters for Services.
Joshua Binder with Southern Label Company.
On the central time zone.
Charles Howard with Plantation Patterns.
Sethine Kisabori at the center set.
Dave Taylor.
Mountain Sign, anybody?
Yes, Emily Anderson from IDFL.
Anybody on the West Coast Pacific time?
Tony Bryan, you're in touch.
The last up in the end of the
day. Dan Stewart, Prison Industry Authority.
Bert Grimes, Advisor Council.
Jimmy Watson, and I'll just go to O'Donnell.
These kinds of type of forms are very important. We believe that we can try to do these as much as we possibly can in the future, and this is it's wonderful that everybody can join in and be part of the discussion, so we can get all kinds of perspectives. The first thing on the agenda here that we put together is we're going to talk about the new examples of the existing law labels to eliminate revenue stamp section. And Rajinder, you were going to talk about that.
Hello, good morning. This is Rajinder, and we're going to eliminate the revenue stamp section from our law label. This section is no longer used by any of the states. The section was used kind of by a few states in the 70s and 80s, and since it's not required, no need to have in our regulations anymore. We already have the examples of the labels without the revenue stamp on our website since July 2015, and California has been accepting the labels with and without the revenue stamps for the past, I think, over past 10 years. So what we're going to do is we're going to replace the example labels with the new pictures without the revenue stamp section.
Any comments? Objections? Well, okay. Number three, the cleanup of existing law labels, examples, and regulations, verbiage, putting in consistency. Rose, you want to mention a few things about that?
Yes. Hi, I'm Rose Dakota. Number three, the cleanup of existing law label examples and regulation verbiage inconsistencies. Going through our regulations, there are a number of either typos or word omissions that upon thorough review should be corrected to bring the examples in line with the verbiage and likewise the verbiage in line with some of the examples. Most are, I can go through them individually, or to give you an example, some like the type number nine label located on page 38, if you have that, we are missing the word new in filling material. Likewise, in certification statements on type 9, we're missing the word, or we've included the word the, and it should be with law. Most of these omissions are fairly small, but once again, we want to have consistency between what's presented and what is actually stated in the regulation itself. Another example that we would like to bring into possibly more prominence would be our type number 4 label that's located on page 35. When you contrast to the number 8 label located on page 37, we want to greater emphasize that the type number 4 label on page 35 is pretty much meant for or better, as opposed to the other label, type number 8, which has to do with upholstered furniture. And for that, the words are a little bit different on the actual label. Additionally, we would like to emphasize a statement in our regulation that the extension and the horizontal lines of the vertical and horizontal lines are intended to go to the edge of the label to more clearly define the section of the label and the start of a different label. So those are some of the things that we see as part of the cleanup of existing law label examples and the regulation verbiage. I'll also go into number 4, just for the sake of expediency, where we've stated the elimination of obsolete passages and verbiage from regulation. Specifically, much of this is in our Article 15.5, our citation regulations. In that area, we are looking to omit, let me get to there, 15.5.
Excuse me, first, Brian, I'm going to ask a quick question back on the cleanup of the existing law labels.
Okay, Mr. Brian?
Yes. You talked about the law labels, the lines dividing the law labels need to go all the way up to the edge of the label.
Yes.
Is there a way that we can use some type of exemption? Because I know a lot of people are printing on their non-printers that are unable to print all the way out to the edge of a law label. So we may need a double line to make the differentiation between the two labels.
Well, I believe this is Terry. I believe that we can consider that, if industry does have issues with the line extending to the width of the law label. However, the reason behind requiring that line to extend the width of the law label is that folks are combining many labels these days. And we do allow the combining of labels, but they have to have be completely separated by a bold black line. Because of this combining, it just made it more reasonable to have each and every section separated out and extending those lines. But we can consider that. Our main concern is that there is a line just to distinguish between the different sections of a law label. And they're definitely, if we're going to allow combining of many labels, we want the line totally extending the width of the label itself. But we can consider your thought there as far as the sections that are contained within the law label.
Well, if we could separate the different law labels by saying double bold lines, something like that, or maybe have a variant where they can extend within one eighth of an inch of the outside of the label.
then you're actually combining different labels, like say the law label and the PLAM label, or folks want to put other labels on the same material as well, or do you just mean within the law label itself?
I mean when we are combining the different law labels.
Okay.
But with now, this is so much easier to go on one law label.
Okay, but you're saying when you do combine them, that there will not be the black line extending the entire width of the label, that you're suggesting a double line, but it does not extend.
Well, I'm suggesting that because of certain printer capacity that don't print out to the edge of pieces of paper, you know, the standard printer, there's always a black border around there. Could we put a double line between the different law labels, you know, a double bold line to separate them and have a variance of maybe 2 inches if they go up to within an eighth of an inch of each of the law label?
Yeah, Mr. Zines, I think that's acceptable, and I would take that as a variance. As long as it's really prominent and it, you know, shows a really defined division between the labels on one. And I think, you know, with the printer capabilities, yeah, they can't go all the way to the edge. So if it's just short of that, if it's really solid and very prominent, I think that would be acceptable. Can you provide some examples of that to us? Just send it up, and then, but I think that should be quite acceptable because it will show the division.
Okay, who would like?
You can send it up to me, or you can send it up to Terry.
Right. So I think it'd be a really good visual to be able to see exactly what you're thinking and considering. Maybe you said the printer capabilities, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, and just finishing up on number four very quickly. As you said, 15.5 page 50 of the reg, just eliminate omit items concerned with fill bedding regulation, liquid fill bedding regulation, 1351 to 60, but we still, our Bureau still does regulate hybrid water beds, and also any 1192.1 Article 5 Plumage Regulations omits reference to comply with federal standards. And that should sum up my number four unless there's questions.
I of course, my name is Dan Nielsen. I understand all these minor changes need to be made. One of the problems manufacturers are having is the dissemination of this type of information to them. I know that you try to put it on your website, but there are a lot of small manufacturers that hold licenses that don't get it. I would suggest that any of these changes were made, that the information be disseminated by mail to each one of the license holders so they all get the information.
Noted. That's a good point.
Thank you.
Okay, so on agenda number five, additional label examples. I know we've been asked in the past if we could put other label examples out into our regulations. We now have label examples on our website that we posted back in July 2015. One of them is the plumage label examples document, and this shows not the intricate plumage label examples, but if you have a bedding product that has down or goose down, feathers and down, this is, you know, mainly for your comforters, maybe your bed pillows, your bedding product. There are much more complicated plumage labels out there, which would have to do with feather and down that's in your furniture. Those get much more complicated. You end up with top, middle, bottom chambers. So what we have offered out on our website right now is the basic plumage label examples. But I guess we just wanted to throw it out there in regards to, would it be helpful to have those built into our regulations as opposed to, we do have the helpful examples out on our website. And the same thing would have to do with the flammability label examples. And actually both of these were in your materials for this workshop. One is labeled plumage label examples, and the other is label examples. Right now for flammability, we have the verbiage built into our regulations. However, we do not have any example flammability labels built into our regulations. And I know folks are very visual, and it might be something that that is needed to put examples in our regulations as opposed to just offering these examples out on our website. So you'll see in the document just titled Label Examples, we have a law label first in that document, which we do have law label examples already in our regs, just that they are outdated. And then we have flammability labels that are compliant CB117-2013 labels that are combined now with our SB1019 information. And so that's kind of what that document is out there right now. But I guess our question out to folks is, is there a need to put both plumage label examples as well as the flammability label examples into our regulations as a, not just a verbiage, but an actual picture, a visual. Any comments on that?
First, again, I think the more information that people have available is to make it the job, to make it compliance a little bit easier.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Darlene Robby from your Veritas. I have a comment. If the information is on the website, I think that's sufficient because if the change is going forward, as long as the wording matches your law, if there's overall detailed changes to the actual label itself to be conforming to other state requirements as well, it may be more advanced pages to post it on the website as opposed to in the law because then the law is outdated. That's my opinion.
Any others?
I think you could reference, this is Maggie Carey from Legal Label. I think you could get to reference IBFL's website too for them to go to that because IBFL does work with trying to get a law label that works across the state, and when it comes to settling down, there's so much to it that there'll be a lot to print.
Right, definitely. Yeah, they have a lot in regards to the blended, the Timberg products. Very useful information out there as well. And with plumage, it gets actually very complicated real fast. So, yeah, we do use their information. We look at their information to try and determine what will be, for instance, the best way to label a product that has different seat back cushions, and there are different chambers, you know, within the product. So, yeah, definitely that's a good tool. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, next going to lead us into number six, update of plumage regulations. Back in 1998, the FTC rescinded the regulations. In 2000, the Bureau put out new regulations for plumage. And those regulations, there's a couple things that we're considering to change and update, really. And part of that was put out in our AB 2740, our sunset review. One of the aspects, one of the materials and the rules and regulations, this is in Article 5, page 40. and it was FSK 42, where we talked about cleanliness. So right now it says all finished products must have an oxygen number not exceeding 20 grams of oxygen per 100,000 grams of sample. We are planning to update that to reflect 10 grams, 10 grams being the cleaner product. And honestly, this update will reflect what is accepted internationally, and it considers the utmost cleanliness for a consumer, tend being a cleaner, cleaner product. As I mentioned, internationally, that's what everybody is going by. We've had 20 in there for a long time, but I have not seen anything greater than 5 grams in the last 2 decades, probably. So I know the Southern and Down is regulated by other associations and folks, and we really got that together in regard to clean products. I do know back in the late 70s, early 80s, definitely we would see oxygen numbers over 20. That was not uncommon, but industry these days, like I said, I haven't seen greater than 5 grams in a couple of decades. So that's one of our plans. And the other one is to adopt a sliding scale for maximum allow for damaged feathers in blended water, fowl feather, and down products. What we have in our reds right now pretty much reflects whether you have between 49% and 50% feathers. We still only allow 2% damage, and we just want to consider that sliding scale to for something. I understand if you're only having a small amount of feathers, you obviously shouldn't have a lot of damaged feathers. But if you have a large amount of damaged feathers, that's just going to indicate that you would have more damaged feathers without inherently adding damaged feathers to your product. That's what we don't want to see. But industry does go by that sliding scale, I know. So we just want to get more in line with what's acceptable internationally. So we are planning to do that. And those are the two main things. I know in our regulations too, there's in our cite and fine section, we're still referring to the federal guidelines. We will definitely update that as well, because that no longer exists. So we'll update that to reflect our Article 5 regulations.
Okay. Any comments?
Alright, so now we'll go right into number 7, which is filling material percentage variance. This was also another comment that was mentioned in our sunset review, that we would like to look into allowing a larger variance. Right now we're at plus or minus 5% that we would allow on our deviations and percentages, and that is 11.13 in our regulations on page 25. It does have a definition for the deviations from percentages stated. However, that definition is not very clear. It's a little complicated in and of itself. It's really allowing a 5% variance, but we are considering a 10% variance, and we would rewrite the verbiage in the regulations to be more clear. I believe this would give industry a little more leeway in their manufacturing processes. And
may I make that a point here? I think we only allow 3%.
3% is in regards to the fabric content. Right, so I mean,
but through the manufacturing process, they are still only allowed that 3%.
Okay, and there are.
That's my understanding of it. So, I would be very concerned about you putting 5 or 10% variance and then having 3% by FTC rules and that being in conflict.
Okay. Well, from what we understand in the Federal Trade Commission is that the 3% is in regards to fabrics. Fabrics meaning it could be the outside cover fabric of upholstered furniture.
That's true.
The apparel wear, you know, whenever you're buying clothes, it cannot vary more than 3%. But in regards to our percentages, we do not consider the outside cover fabric fiber content. We are considering only the inside filling materials, resilient filling materials. So any all new material consisting of specs on the law label, only the resilient filling materials are listed there along with their percentages. So that's really what our deviation is talking about as far as the percentages. Outside cover fabric of upholstered furniture can be stated in the other information section. You know, if it's 100% cotton fabric, we'll allow that in the other information section, but that does not belong in the only materials consisting of section.
This is Heather from DB.
Hi.
In regards to the FTC, for like bedding products, if it's filling materials there for warmth, it must be declared. So then you're looking at that plus or minus 3%.
For bedding products, yeah, I know when you're looking at in the FTC requirement, right? They do talk about for warmth. Yeah, so that would definitely not be in regards to upholstered furniture. We'll have to look into that. Yeah. Right, to make sure we're in line with that. I do know as far as percent variances, Ohio has a plus or minus 10%. Utah has a plus or minus 3%. Oklahoma has a plus or minus 10%. Pennsylvania has a zero tolerance. And Connecticut has a plus or minus 10%. So those are the states that require percentages and their variances, and so we're just thinking to get more in line with a couple of those other regulating states as well.
Yeah. I'd rather have you get in line with the Fed so we don't have to argue with the public.
Well, we will definitely contact them to see what their take is on that, because I know the exact section that Heather's talking about, right, where they talk about warmth.
Right.
This
is for three, and I think the other aspect of it is also, if it's for warmth, you have to disclose it, but if you want to truly disclose it, it's still, now you're making claim, and again, then it will follow in the FTC's requirements as well, in which case the rules will apply as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not required, but if you do, so for example, structural purposes, if you're using those, and now if you disclose it voluntarily, you still have to meet the requirements of the rule, because now you're self-disclosing as opposed to requirements within the rule.
Okay.
I think personally, I think it creates a lot of confusion within industry if you allow those variances to be so far off the federal. I mean, trying to make people understand the differences between that is very difficult.
So this is Ken Nielsen with CFMA. The states you mentioned, a lot of them have basically non-enforcement of some of those rules. So for example, Utah, I don't think they even have an enforcement on either one of those.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I believe Utah does not even have an even enforcement on operating, and being at 3% is really irrelevant to what they say. The other thing is, I think when you're dealing with a upholstery furniture, and that's what I'm speaking on behalf of, if you're dealing with many different components, when you're dealing with a comforter, it's one or two components. When you're dealing with a piece of clothing, it's one component, usually maybe two. And when you're dealing with upholstered furniture, there are many, many multiple components. And it's very hard, it's almost impossible to get even within 5% on that unless you have just a full-time staff operating and doing these kind of measurements. So I think maybe there's a difference between some of the different things that are, you know, the bedding, there's a difference in bedding and clothing and on top of bed and upholstery. So maybe the variance would be different for different groups.
This is Bert Grimes, and I think basically what we're talking about is filling material on the upholstered furniture, and that is sold in the state of California, and is regulated by the state of California. I personally, and I know a lot of people in the industry, and get support from other groups, to eliminate the actual percentage and list the materials, the new materials, list them on the law label based on an order of promise based on the weight. Just the same way that we figure the percentages right now, only we don't have these specific percentages in it. In other words, if foam was the heaviest component, that would be listed first, Dacron would be listed second, or the new second.
Well, but that, the law label now needs to be global. And if you even if you eliminate the state of California, it still won't work for the rest of the state. And for those of us in industry, we can't look at this existing California. We have to, you know, be approaching it as a global marketplace. And this meeting, I'm assuming, is not just about upholstered furniture, it's about mattresses and foundations and top of the bed and et cetera. So when you draft the law label, you know, you're drafting a law label that works for the particular item that you're doing, top of the bed or furniture, but you're still only working with the same regulations.
Well, I mean, the California regulation, the finability law, is not nationwide, obviously. So there are different requirements for different states. And as long as stuff that's shipped into California meets whatever California regulation is, I mean, I can go on and on about the difference in the state and the federal regulations and the different state regulations. Lots of different things. So I don't think you'll ever get to a universal law label for the whole country, the whole world. That isn't going to happen. So.
And then, you know, I think the other part is if you give a variance, this time the variance is 5%, next time somebody makes it 10%, you know, it's not defined, it's not definite.
You know, and that brings up another point, if you want to go a little bit further with first comment here, is that what we're really trying to do here is inform the consumer what's in the product. If they have any problems with the things in the product, their health issues with it, or whatever. As long as we do that, and we also tell them the quality of the product. The percentage has nothing to do with quality. A two-pound piece of foam, you know, is better than a 1.8 piece of foam, and it's a difference in weight. But these percentages have nothing with quality. In terms of quality, that's one of the things that's been brought up many times. Well, you know, the consumer won't know the quality. Well, they will know the quality by what's in the product. For percentages, they really don't mean anything to the consumer. I mean, we've done some preliminary talking to retail furniture stores, and the retail furniture salesmen really don't even know what the reason for the percentages are. They want to know what's in there. There's so much of this, so much foam. So much fiber, you know, there's foam, there's fiber, there's feathers, there's wood, there's, you know, whatever, that's what it is.
Well, I don't think you find the same thing in necessarily the mattress industry, because I deal with a lot of the mattress, and they mean that California doesn't require a call out of viscoelastic polyurethane foam. There is another state that does, and I know one of the reasons that consumers want to know if you're buying a visceral foam mattress, you know, some of the they want to know how much of that is visceral, how much is rest of that is just plain polyurethane.
Right, because in that case, there are certain foams that cost more than others. Threaded foam is a lesser product than a polyurethane foam pad.
My question is threaded foam. Everybody talks about shredded foams of lesser quality. If you want to buy some shredded memory foam, tell you what, it's more than regular foam.
Yeah.
Okay, so shredded foam. Now, there is junk shredded foam.
Right.
But there's also junk, junk viscose foam. It's nothing to do with the shredded foam. It's not a bad thing.
Right. Not that's true. Not necessarily, but Without percentages, you really don't know, because it could be your first component would be 50% of a particular product. The next component may be 49%, but it's true, 50 is more than 49, so then that component would come first. You might have, I mean, in that case, you're almost a 50-50, but that wouldn't be indicated if you were just going by, you know, the highest percentages listed first, such as a food item, you know.
Good point. Anything further? Okay. Definitions for gender, do you want to talk about the changes there?
Sure. This is Rajinder. We are also planning to add new definitions to our resolutions. The definitions those were kind of have been missing from our regulation, and to provide some kind of more clarity or better interpretation for the manufacturer or the consumer. And some of the definitions that we are planning to add are mattresses, definition of mattresses that has been missing, resilient filling material versus just the filling material, new materials, and textile waste tags like bedding of unknown kind. And we're going to also add to make sure to include 5% thread as a qualifier for the waste product, because if it contains 5 or more, it would be considered a waste fiber. And then we'll also be adding barriers, decking, dust covers, outdoor furniture, pre-consumer and post-consumer products, because the post-consumer product is not allowed on the law label. It has to be new product. And then we'll be describing surely attached, any disruptions, for example, advertising trademarks, viscoelastic polyurethane foam, silk. And these are some of the examples. And if anyone you will have any additional that you would like to see in our regulations, you're most welcome to let us know.
Can you put gel in there too for the foam?
The gel is already in our regulations.
That gel pieces versus, you know, the gel. Swirl, so now that we're able to define that in the new material area. What we're seeing in the industry for mattresses, when we do labeling, we're seeing a lot of people that are using like maybe just a straight polyurethane foam to be one part of the slab, and then they're using that polyurethane foam embedded with gel beads or a swirl, and then they might be using a third level of viscoelastic.
Right, we can look into those definitions. I know we've had some issues with that, infused with gel, embedded with gel pieces. Right. Okay, well known.
Anything further?
Oh, I have a question, Rajinda. You said post-consumer is not allowed. Post-consumer products are not allowed?
Yes.
So, can you define post-consumer?
Like the post-consumer products that have been already been used.
So, a milk carton or a milk bottle, jug, soda bottle that's been reformulated, what does that fall under?
But that goes through a process of intense heat, and at the end product in that case would be a new product.
Okay.
When I say post-consumer, it's kind of old fabric from your dress, or from, for example, from India, old sari from grandmother. That would be the post-consumer product.
Can I ask a question on this? If someone is using like that test or that bottle product, okay, and that's basically remanufactured product.
Mm-hmm.
And you consider that a new product at this point?
Yeah, then melt it down and reinsert it into a new fiber. So we consider that a new fiber at that point.
Okay. So if somebody advertised that it was made from recycled material, even though it was remanufactured and it's a new product, and they use a new material law label, do you see that as being in conflict?
What are they going to indicate under the all new materials?
It's all new materials, the polyurethane, you know, fiber batting, which is potentially what comes out of it. Or
okay.
But they're putting on their marketing
recycled,
made from recycled components or made from recycled materials.
I would think that we do allow that. I mean, under all new materials consisting of, it would be listed as just polyester fiber 100%. And what we see sometimes is that polyester fiber would be a green in color as opposed to a white, or it might be a brownish in color. But in regards to your advertising, as long as it's truthful advertising, so, is that considered a recycled product? I would think that's appropriate.
I think the conflict comes up because you have this label that says new material.
Right. Here's like the issue. You have a label that says all new material,
mm-hmm.
and then you're putting on your advertising made from recycled product.
Yeah, but when you say made from recycled process, it has gone through through a process of remanufacturing. At the end, it's a new material. It's not kind of shredded bottles that has been broken down and placed in as a filling material. That would be recycled. But if it goes through the process of
remanufacturing.
So it's at the end, that's what we have accepted as that as a new material.
Yeah, I think we all accept that it's new material. The conflict comes is when a company wants to be green, as they say, and says that it's manufactured from recycled bottles or whatever the product might be. There could be considered a conflict.
Mm-hmm. Right, we do have a definition in our regulations for recycled fibers, that mean new fibers, which are the byproduct resulting from a textile processing method. Such recycled fibers shall not have a thread content in excess of 5%. So the problem with the recycled fibers is shall mean new fibers. So
I think it's something that needs to be more research and
Research.
We'll follow up on the specific consistency.
Yeah.
Good point.
This is Charles Howell with Plantation Patterns, and that's a significant issue we're dealing with a large retailer as well, with the exact same situation. So any input we could get on that would be appreciated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think this kind of stems back to with all the state law labels, which, you know, do not allow the use of recycled fibers.
Correct. That seems like
that's a big issue.
Yeah. It seems like the regulations are getting a little bit old at this point. So recycling obviously didn't exist at one point. Now that it does, you have this class of materials that are, on the one hand, considered recycled, but yeah, I would agree with the position that if they're re-extruded, they are new material. It's just they could be potentially 100% post-consumer content that is a new material.
True, yeah.
Number nine. This is the code again. Wait a minute. Can we go back to eight for a second?
Sure.
Can you folks define the difference between, a pad that you need to give your network of filling material versus like a mattress pad that doesn't necessarily need it because it's not in your label example. The word pad in your definition, it's been very difficult for people to understand the variation differences when they need to have net weight of filler mill.
Right. So when is net weight of filler material required? In our label example, right, for the type number 7 on page 31, says looking back has masses including a hybrid flotation plate system containing cold dish fabric cover over traditional water-filled water, box springs, and similar items. Similar items is not very clear and concise. And the word has is also not very clear and concise. Now, when they talk about sleeping bags, pads, and mattresses, my thought is sleeping pads, would that better define it in that area? Meaning a pad that you would sleep on. Now that
if you don't consider that to be a mattress pad, and you don't require net weight of fill for that.
Right, so then you flip the page over to page 30, site number 6, and we're talking about a law label that only has a finish size on it now. Now, thank goodness, mattress pads is actually spelled out there, so as opposed to all the other different types of pads that we get, and then we have to fit them into more or less a type 6, or is it a type 7? Yeah, you're right. So for articles of bedding, such as bedfellows, comforters, mattress pads, and similar items, that would be the law label where you do need a finish size stated.
And
good note, well noted, maybe you can kind of clean that up so it's more explanatory, more concise on what needs a finished size and what needs a net weight. And
right.
I know we're getting new products all the time, really creative manufacturers out there. So we still may not be able to encompass every single product, but at least we can try and offer clarity there. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that seems to be a good segue into number 9, review of allowances of format and verbiage on law labels. Specifically, the case of tennis sites. As you can see from our law label examples, numbers 6, 7, and 9, they display finish size in the all new material section. We understand for many years other states have had finish size at the bottom of the law label. We have allowed that in the past, but we intend to make that more clear in our examples, in our statement, and our regulations, that that is permissible, and either case would be acceptable, but more importantly, to give the nod that, yes, finish size is acceptable in the bottom. Likewise, the net weight, if anyone needs to have compliance with other states, the net weight would be allowed in the bottom of the law label. So those are a few of the changes or we are hoping to incorporate. Likewise, the made for and made by, if there are still states that require that or want that, make that a little bit more clear that is acceptable in the optional information section. And then to incorporate several of the items that we have in our frequently asked questions, examples, ranging from questions and answers 10 through 14 and 21, some of which we have covered, but once again, reiterating that, okay, can I print, for instance, number 11? Can I print the barcode, the SKU, the keeping unit code, the UPC code on the bottom of the label? We understand that there's been greater requests, greater input, greater desire to have these incorporated, the information on and I hate to say on the law label, but certainly at the bottom of the law label. And we have allowed it, provided the information and the size requirements for the law label have been met. And there's a line clearly separating the law label from this additional information printed at the bottom of the law label. We also understand that certain states, although California does not require content sterilized for plumage, nor do we, we don't require permit number to be permitted. We don't require it to be printed on the law label. However, we do acknowledge that other states do have this requirement. So likewise, we have accepted it and will hope to incorporate, if it were clear in our regulations, that it is acceptable. So those will take care of, some of those will take care of 12 and 13. 14, further explanation that the RN number, what is an RN number? Once again, we understand that is a requirement for in certain instances. Once again, it can be permitted, but likewise at the bottom of the law label. 21, there's not going to finish by. Once again, as long as it's expressed in, we expect it to be printed in either the all new material section for California or at the bottom, as long as it's stated in pounds and ounces or inches, as the case may be, at the bottom of the law label would be perfectly acceptable. As you can see on number 10, it states that can I print information on the back of the law inflammability label? Okay, we still do not allow printing on the back of the law inflammability label, however, with the one exception. As of 2005, we have allowed retailers and or importers of wholesalers to place a barcode or UPC in the stamp or sticker format on the bottom, following the other information section of the law label, or on the back of the law label. So that is something we are looking into actually including in the regulations. Are there any questions?
The other states are so strict about not allowing on the back of the law label. I guess I would prefer to see that you didn't get that consistent throughout the industry.
Can you repeat that?
Other states don't allow any printing, any stickers or anything on the back of the law label. So if you're considering allowing that to be clear that they can put information on the back of the law label, like a sticker or UPC code and stuff, I would, for industry level, I would prefer that you just kept it consistent with everyone else and did no printing or anything on the back of the law label.
Okay.
Any other questions or any comments about that? Good point, though. Consistency.
I have one other question I have to ask. In your regulations, you state that the font sizes need to be 1/8 inch. But your label examples don't show that everything has to be 1/8 inch. And that has caused some confusion. So,
Everything doesn't have to be 1/8 of an inch.
But that's not what your regulation says. It says in there, mm-hmm. your font size should be 1/8 inch. It's not until we get to your pictures that it indicates differently.
Okay, we can make up.
Oh, definitely. Okay. That's a real good point. How would that need to be changed? Yeah, because we get that often where people look at those examples as a way to comply, and it's not consistent, and that's not right.
And I guess another question I have is, as some of you know, that I am the author of the Manual of Law Labeling for FSBA. and IAFLO has accepted the label drafts and stuff that are in that manual for industry. I'm wondering if you have folks have taken a look at that to see how much of that you could make consistent to be throughout the industry in your regulations.
Right, definitely. We'll keep that in mind when we are considering label examples that are the ones that are going to be input into our regulations.
Any further questions or comments?
This is Charles Howard from Plantation Patterns again. I would just agree that the ISPO manual is incredibly valuable to manufacturers because even going through the California laws, again, we see that where some documentation will say one thing and other documentation will say the other thing, and sometimes the label format example won't be quite as compliant as maybe, you know, the intricacies of certain parts of the regulation in terms of formatting. And so any closer we could get to like having, you know, even the label examples make sure that they're kind of, I mean, obviously the regulations are incredibly important because that's the law, but if the examples could show, like, the details of what actually has to be an eighth of an inch, what doesn't, the things have to be bold, if the lines have to go, you know, call it, extend the edge of the page, those kind of details are really, really helpful to call out specifically because they're just kind of nested in so many different places, it's hard to see in one spot. So, I mean, you kind of have to learn by trial and error to a certain extent.
And you see what's happening right now, just on a global level here, is that, you know, products are being tested, but the testing labs will be tested. And right now, they're looking at that vetting law label that's not put out by IFPA and accepted by IAFLO. And if it doesn't match it, they're getting failed. So this is really, really important that those are all kind of tied together here for the place of industry.
That's very important, yeah.
And I'm about ready to republish the law label manual with some changes for the law label because of issues from the state of Virginia and et cetera. And I didn't want to publish until we went through this meeting here because, you know, I'm concerned about misinformation again getting back out there. So it's a big concern for me because I work with so many people in the industry that depend upon that manual.
Right, and I think in your manual as well, you have a qualifier in there that you should also check with the states that are that your product is being sold in. Right, just to ensure that they are meeting all the requirements of each and every regulating state.
But you understand that's not practical, right?
Right. Well, it's...
I mean, you understand that you've got 50 states here and 31 and a half have vetting regulations.
Right.
And 14 of you make it pay a fee for it, and 5 of you or 6 of you actively inspect, and if you 5 or 6 or 8 states that are out there that are inspecting, along with the testing labs, that are failing for the minutia, that's the difference between the different states.
Right. Yeah, and as far as the ISPO manual, we also, you know, provide input in regards to this document. So thank you for that. We do try and make sure that our California information is reflected.
Mm-hmm.
Next item, number 10, additional cyber terminology discussion. Okay. Acknowledging that since our regulations were last revised, there have been changes to the industry. Okay. For this reason, it would seem a good opportunity to open for discussion and give consideration to possible changes or additions to cyber terminology. So at this time, we would like to begin the dialogue. but with the understanding that any proposed changes or additions expressed will be reviewed for consideration.
I would simply like to add that you and Ohio get on the same page for some terminology differences.
So Maggie, could you, this is Emily from IDFL, could you give them examples of one of the major problems that you see between the two states?
Well, the polyurethane issue is big for the mattress industry. The gel versus the pieces versus the swell, the disco. You know, the guys who have these high-end mattresses, they want to have this stuff called out if they're marketing that stuff on the label. And it's hard for me to explain, or for one to explain, you know, why that gel information for beads or swirls is not in that new material. They just, they don't understand. And I guess the other thing that's not totally understood, and it sounds like you are addressing it here, is the difference between a resilient and a non-resilient textile, so people can understand what needs to be in that new material. And one of them to point out is some fire stuff that go on mattresses. They're basically a textile, but they're not disclosed in the new material area. They certainly could be disclosed in the other section of the law label, but, you know, some of those fire stocks are 10% of the, you know, weight, so it's hard to make people understand why that does not have to be listed in the new material area because it's basically a non-resilient textile. So somehow if those definitions were explained better, it might be easier to explain to people who are doing mattress sales and trying to get it to the law label correctly.
Right. Some of the barriers used in mattresses, they can come in many forms. They can come as a pad, as a batting, as a fabric. When you're talking about the soft, that's usually a knit fabric. And so fabrics are not disclosed in all new material consisting of sections. In regards to the infused and embedded with gel beads, we had opted to put that information in the other section of the law label, simply because we could not quantify, for instance, how many gel beads are in a product. The entire component itself is polyurethane foam pad. It is a viscoelastic as well. But how many beads were actually embedded into that product? And, you know, were there a small amount of beads, or there were two or three? And now, as you know, although we have not seen that, we haven't seen any falsifying and advertising. Usually if they are gel beads, they are dispersed throughout the product. It's not as if there were, you know, 10 of them and they're claiming they have gel beads in their product. I have not seen that, any false advertising as yet. But that was our initial take on, you know, the placing that information in the all new material section. Now, I do know from a lot of conversations and emails going back and forth that that is an issue. So we will definitely look into that and how we might be more in line with Ohio. I know anytime it comes to terminology, we work very closely with Ohio because they are the other lab throughout the state that have capability to identify. As far as I know, it's only Ohio and California at this point. So I understand your thing there. Yeah. Okay. Any other suggestions on terminology? Okay. All right. So on to number 11, product and immutability. Review definitions of upholstery furniture and bedding. We wanted just to kind of throw this out there to the folks in regards to our definitions. you know, you might say, why is the definition important? It's very important because depending on what your product is, and we get many new different products, as I mentioned earlier, very creative marketplace out there. And we have to look at the product itself. We usually ask for pictures of the product. We ask for advertising, marketing, intended use, because we need to best determine whether that product fits under upholstery, furniture, or bedding. If it's a bedding product, with exception of mattresses and mattress pads, there are no flammability regulations. Mattresses, of course, have their 16 CFR 1632 and 1633. Mattress pads are 1632, federal flammability standards. But comforters, bed pillows, decorative pillows, those are considered bedding items. They fit more into the bedding definition written into our law, and so those products need licensing, they need law labels. But when we're looking at a product, if it is deemed to be upholstery furniture based on the definition in our law, those products now need licensing, law label, the TB 117-2013 compliant label, as well as the flame retardant chemical labeling. So once a product is deemed upholstery furniture, there are other requirements for upholstery furniture that do not affect bedding products. So we just wanted to throw this out there to see if folks feel that the definition should maybe be better clarified. Now that is in our law, so that would that's a different change than it would be for changes in our regulations. But I know it's just difficult. It's difficult for us, and I'm sure it's difficult for the manufacturers as well to determine, you know, is my product considered upholstery furniture and or bedding. So, any comments on that?
I absolutely agree with you. You need better imagine. Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's so many new products out there that typically now we're have to send them to you and Regenda and ask you, what do you qualify this as?
Right, right. And we, a lot of times they'll send us websites, addresses so that we can go out there and really take a look at their product. We have companies that send us pages of different products and their question is, you know, where would all of these products fall into? What category, bedding or upholstery furniture? Right, and that kind of brings us right into number 12 for product exemption. We have now a total of 18 Dismal product exemptions. We started out with about 10, but as of January 1, 2014, we added a few more, and so we have 18 total exemptions out there. And we tried to include all the juvenile products that had, they did not contain a lot of fuel load, you know, thin pads, things like that, that really would not be any type of significant safety hazard in regards to flammability. And we have a couple other areas too. Outdoor furniture, of course, is exempt. Now, we do go into the outdoor furniture, meaning that it must be used and intended to be used outdoors only. So anything that is advertised as, you know, if you can use this indoors as well as outdoors, if you're using it indoors, then it is still amenable to the TB 117-2013 and the FR chemical labeling. The half-inch rule, there's not a lot of upholstery furniture that really falls into that category because even the smallest, you know, slip seats are usually at least an inch in thickness. So, therefore, the half-inch, that rule will not apply to that product. But these are all products. There's a few others that we've came across in the past year or two that we would like to probably incorporate into that exempt area for juvenile products. And I guess we just wanted to add this on the agenda so that if other folks knew of other products, that new products, different products, and kind of the rule of thumb is if, you know, if it's been brought up at least a couple times, it might mean that it should be added. You know, it has its own distinct title to be added to the exemption in digital products area. So any comments on those?
Nobody sharing our misery?
I think another good thing to put in the definitions is you have bedding pillows, okay? You have the decorative pillows. You also have, you know, pillows which are used for floor pillows. You also have pillows that are used on sofas. You know, many times we still get this question, you know, pillow opposed to furniture, pillow to fall under CD117, or a pillow bedding.
Right, right. And I think we, I'm not sure which FAQ that we, it might have been our CD117-2013 FAQ, where we, and I'm sorry, that would be out on our website. That wasn't out there as part of our materials for this workshop. But definitely there's that one that always comes up where if it's a decorative pillow on the shelves of any retail establishment, regardless of size, I mean, it could be a 12 by 12, it could be a 24 by 24 inch pillow. But if it's sold separately, it's intended to be used as a decorative pillow. It's bedding only, no flammability requirements. But when it is sold, that same decorative pillow, when it's sold with the set of furniture, so you buy a love seat, and that love seat includes four decorative pillows that are sold with it. Now those decorative pillows do have to meet the CD117-2013, which will include the Flametime chemical statement. So there is a distinction there in regards to those two scenarios. Yeah.
What if it's a pillow that's like 36 by 36?
Well, I would then say, is it sold separately on a shelf, intended to be used really as a decorative pillow? If so, even though it is very large, it would be considered a decorative pillow. Now, if it was a cushion that was sold by a supplier that's 36 by 36 and he's selling it to a furniture manufacturer, and that manufacturer is going to take that 36 by 36 cushion and he's going to, it will essentially be the back cushion of his sofa. You know, he'll buy three because you're going to have your wood frame with maybe a little bit of polyester and then your outside cover fabric. And then you're going to place those three cushions as a back cushion. If you took those back cushions off of that, the body of the product, you're just getting your back against wood, essentially. So then those are part of the furniture, and they have to meet 117. They're back cushions of a set, you know. And so that supplier who is selling those 36 by 36 to his customer, who's a manufacturer, all the folks involved need to be aware of that situation. But certainly a 36 by 36 pillow that has a very decorative cover, it's sold along with the other 18 by 18 or 12 by 12 inch decorative pillows on the shelf there. It's intended to be used as a decorative pillow. There's nothing, you know, it's not a back cushion of an actual chair or a sofa. It would still be considered a decorative pillow, even though it's very large in size.
And what about a body pillow?
Those are those very long ones, right, long and narrow. Those are considered bedding. Those are generally used in the bed. Not completely like a bed pillow, but they're used in the bed, and those are considered bedding. But good point. Things like body pillows, that can be just called out a little better in our regulations. Yeah.
I think it would also be helpful for
for example, a holster bed, where that falls under bedding, makes that clearer in some areas.
Okay. The upholstery headboard?
Yes.
Okay. Right. Yeah, because the only place that we really talk about upholstered headboards is a type number one label. So, you know, type number one label, it mentions, you know, quilted bedspreads, headboards, and hatchets. But the question was still, the other valid question is, yeah, okay, that's the law label that goes on the headboard, but does it have to meet 2D117-2013, right? Is it so?
Yes.
Is it considered bedding or is it considered upholstered furniture? Right. Okay, good point. Okay.
Next agenda item, I'm talking about stickers amending the label.
Okay. The allowance of stickers for the label correction. Generally, we offer some type of variance for corrections on the law label. This is a quick way for the manufacturer to correct the errors on the label without kind of facing an economic harm of reprinting all the new labels, because we understand printing of the new label is very expensive. However, the variance is not automatically granted, a written request has to be made by the manufacturer or the importer. And the other requirement is when we allow for the stickers have to comply with all the labeling requirements as mentioned in Article 2. They should be non-tearable, font size be 1/8 of an inch. And it should be razor proof. It has to meet all the requirements. We have allowed it for a while, so that was a plan to add these in our regulations.
Any objections for us using stickers to do quick fixes? This is a temporary label.
Only in the state of North Carolina they don't allow it.
Yeah. One of the things that actually comes up with enforcement is what they're doing, if they're trying to order new labels, it takes time to get those new labels, and that means you're putting product off sale. And if you're able to print up a sticker that meets the requirements, and it's not terrible, or seems to be very structurally firm, then it's allowable, so they can actually continue on. Do you perceive any issues with this, anybody?
I've got one question. I'm Joshua Finn, Southern Label. We've done this for several customers over the years, and, you know, there's two products that are generally offered. One, of course, is a pressure-sensitive Tyvek label, so it's Tyvek to meet all the state's regulations. However, sometimes, you know, just the way Tyvek is manufactured, it has high and low spots in it, so the opacity might not be good enough to cover up what they're, you can still see a little bit of what they're trying to cover.
Mm-hmm.
So some customers, of course, after we tell them, hey, you need to ask your state, make sure that whatever state these are going into, that they're going to be okay with it. They'll ask for a label, a pressure-sensitive label that has an opaque adhesive that totally blocks out what's below it, and then we apply a gloss over-laminate onto this paper label, which essentially makes it untearable.
Yeah.
So the state of California agreed that putting that gloss over-lam on a paper label, making it untearable. I mean, unless you're really trying, state of California to see that as being an issue?
I don't think so.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, you can send us some information about that. That'd be great. We've seen some really good labels out there that are perfectly fine. We've seen some that just fall off and they end up on the bottom of the warehouse floor. So, yeah, we try to be understanding to that. And
in accepting some alternatives here, and if that's something you're interested in, that'd be great.
That's true.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, down to the last item here. Any comments? Any further comments on all the what we've discussed in, from the public? We have one person coming to our table. Okay. Anybody out there? Any further?
Just a quick question, more than comment, I guess. So all of the this is the piece, all of the discussions that we've had and the support revisions that are that are being considered. So I would assume that, you know, there will be a formal document that will be published for the public comment for the rule revision. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're going to a formal stage here that will be open for comment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in the future, we're hoping to do more of these because these are very valuable to us and just trying to be consistent with others, but also trying to adapt to some of the new materials and the new products that are coming out and then just be up with the times. And we're hoping to do more of these in the year 2017. So we really appreciate everybody's participation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. I'm trying to push the button.